I will inform your superiors of police harassment. But you invited me, protested Charlie. You said you had something interesting to show me upstairs. I said nothing of the kind, shouted Olivia. Charlie sighed and held up a small tape recorder. I have it here. Would you like me to play it for my sergeant? Olivia crumpled and burst into tears. Hamish was sure they were tears of rage and frustration, but Charlie lumbered forward and took her in his arms. There, there, he said. You tell Charlie all about it. I'll wait for you at the end of the drive, said Hamish. But it was over half an hour before Charlie got into his car and drove to meet Hamish. Hamish saw Charlie's face was glowing, and there was a mark of lipstick on his cheek. I should have stayed, said Hamish. I bet she told you it was her man's idea to stick her out in the wilds, and that they haven't had sex in ages, and she gets so lonely and— All right, shouted Charlie, his face flaming. Let's just drop it. Look, said Hamish, we've got work to do. Instead of going to Drim, leave your car at the hotel and come with me up the west coast, and let's see if anyone spotted anything suspicious. Hamish decided to ignore the whole matter of Olivia for the present. For Charlie to tape record what she said meant a Charlie who was not all that willing to be taken in. But would Olivia leave Charlie alone? On a previous case, a high-ranking police officer had risked her job and her marriage in pursuit of Charlie. But at the hotel, after Charlie had climbed into the passenger seat and had thrown a couple of bones to the dogs in the back, Hamish couldn't resist asking, "Did you get anything useful out of Olivia?" Charlie's normally smooth brow creased in thought. "Just an impression, mind. Sort of as if she had on a flirty mask, and behind it she was frightened. Maybe we'll get Inverness police to take a closer look at Maggie's. Damn, I should have told them in the first place. Tell Jimmy. Too late. Inverness police will go to Maggie's, and the fragrant Maggie will tell them about our visit. What about that pal of yours? Mungo Davidson? Well, I didn't bother, because I heard a couple of weeks ago that he was on holiday. First stop, I'll call him. Let's start off at Cromish. Sadie Mackay in the village shop might have heard something. That's where Anka used to do the baking, said Charlie. When's the wedding? Next month. I'm to be best man. Dick's complaining that Anka has so many Polish relatives coming here for the wedding, there won't be enough room for all of them. Anka, an attractive Polish woman, was to marry Dick Fraser, Hamish's ex-constable turned successful baker. Hamish could still not understand how the dumpy Dick had managed to capture such a beauty. They drove into the small village of Cromish and parked outside the shop. Hamish got out and stretched. Then he let the dogs out and watched them chasing each other round in circles. "Sonsi used to do that," said Hamish, remembering his wildcat. "Used to play with lugs." "Oh, well." He choked back an impulse to cry, and followed Charlie into the shop.
"It's yourself, Hamish," cried grey-haired Sadie. "And who will this be? My, you're a giant of a fellow."
Hamish introduced Charlie.
"We'll be buying some stuff for our lunch. I've got a wee bit of mackerel for your cat.
I sent her back to the wild.
Still got Baps?" "Aye, Anka sends up a big bag of frozen ones, and that keeps me going."
"Before we start shopping," said Hamish, "you'll have heard about the dead professor."
"Aye, shocking. God's judgment on the poor wee man."
"I'm afraid it was human judgment, and we think it may be the work of smugglers. Have you heard any whispers about cheap cigarettes or booze being smuggled in?"
"Not a thing. Now, what can I get you? What about a couple of sausage baps?"
The days had turned fine, so they took their lunch down to the beach, where great glassy green waves rolled in from the Atlantic.
"Good sausage," said Hamish. "Is there anywhere outside Scotland that has square sausage?"
"Don't think so," said Charlie. "She was lying, wasn't she?"
"I'm afraid so," said Hamish. "Oh, it'll be a man in a van with cheap booze or cigarettes, and times are hard for the small shopkeeper. I could get a search warrant and come back, but I'll finish eating and then suggest it might be easier if she just told me about it, and that way we can keep her out of court.
I don't think smugglers would use Cromish, said Charlie. Looks too open.
There are caves and cliffs just round that end, said Hamish. I nearly forgot Mungo. I'll give him a call.
Mungo listened carefully as Hamish talked about Maggie's and Olivia's visit.
What we want to know is what a rich and sophisticated lady and a daft professor were doing in a dump like that. I know I should have told you. Please don't let them know I was on their patch.
Don't do it again, you wanker, said Mungo.
Now here's the thing. We've had plain clothes in at Maggie's, slurping her lousy coffee and eating the salmonella special, and found out sod all. You see, there's been whispers of drug dealing going on there. Anyway, I'll let you know. Off the record, of course. And in return, next time I'm up your way, you can buy me and my fiancée dinner.
Fiancée? But you're married.
Got the divorce last year. This will be wife number 3.
Good luck with this one, said Hamish.
He rang off and turned to Charlie.
Finished? Then let's get the dogs back in the Land Rover and go and make one wee body's life a misery. Maybe we'll try the back door of the shop first.
At the back of the shop was a battered old Ford van. Sadie and a tall, pimply youth with ginger hair were loading a box into the back of it. Her normally rosy cheeks turned white when she saw Hamish.
"I'll just be having a wee keek into those boxes, Sadie," said Hamish.
"Get a warrant, pig," said the youth.
Hamish ignored him.
"Sadie," he said gently, "I can get a warrant, and Charlie will go and get it, and I will wait right here until it arrives. If I find what I think I'm going to find, and have applied for a warrant, I will need to charge you with a crime, and I don't want to do that."
"I'm telling you, man, you creep me out," said the youth.
"Och, change the TV channel inside your weak brain," said Hamish. "Sadie? Come on, lass, what's it to be?"
"Go home, Geordie," said Sadie.
"I'm afraid Geordie stays right here," said Hamish.
Geordie stepped forward, swinging his fists. Charlie picked him up as if he were a small child and placed him on top of a crate, saying,
"Sit there and shut up."
Geordie burst into tears, and between gulps and sobs, said he did not want to go to prison where he would be made to peddle his ass. Despite the boy's height, Hamish judged him to be no more than 15. Sadie scrubbed her eyes with her apron and said wearily,
"Go ahead, it's just cigarettes. I haven't sold any yet."
Hamish opened a box she pointed to and stared down at it in surprise.
"Sadie, these are e-cigarettes. These are the things people use to give up smoking."
"It's just one box," said Sadie. "They normally cost about £20 each, and he was letting me have them for 10.
"And what did he charge for the stuff to put in them?"
"What stuff?"
"You get little bottles of either nicotine flavour or fruit flavour, and they fill up thon little wells near the top. Anyway, I'll need to confiscate this. I'm after smugglers, Sadie, not two-bit chancers."
"Why did you do it?"
"After Anka left, people stopped coming from all over. It wasn't just her baps, but her cakes, you know. And even up here, business rates and taxes are miserable. He said people would go mad for these. But after I'd bought them, I felt so guilty. I did not want to put them out for sale." "Keep them out the back and don't try to sell them," said Hamish.
"When was this?"
"About 3 weeks ago." "Have you a security camera in the shop?"
"I'll look for you, Hamish. But I play over a lot of the discs. It was only 3 weeks ago, about 5 in the evening, so I might still have it."
Sadie had not used the relevant disc again, and Charlie and Hamish took it out to the Land Rover, where they slotted it into Hamish's computer. They ran it forward to around 5 in the evening and waited. Then a small, squat man came in and leaned over the counter.
"That's Fatty Crumb," exclaimed Charlie.
"Who's Fatty Crumb?" asked Hamish.
"He lives in one of those tower blocks by the docks," said Charlie. "Petty thief, but not violent."
"We'll pay him a visit. I'll go and calm Sadie down, and tell that silly boy to keep his mouth shut while you get this fatty's address."
"I'll have a word with Jimmy, But when we're practically on Fatty's doorstep, or he'll try to get in there first and keep us out. Aren't you worried one of the villagers might blab about the contraband? I mean, the idiot child Geordie? Asked Charlie.
It doesn't matter if he talks. They'll all clam up to protect Sadie.
Jimmy had arranged to meet them down at the docks in a cafe that made Maggie's look posh.
I'm not pleased with you, began Jimmy angrily. We get a call from Mungo Davidson in Inverness that Olivia Sinclair was seen in Maggie's cafe with none other than the dead prof. So I get out to the middle of nowhere and ask the lady. She says, huffily, she told you all about it.
So she did, put in Charlie quickly. It was when I was having dinner at the hotel that she came up to our table and we got talking.
And you never thought to call me?
We told me, said Hamish.
Tried to get you. Your phone must be on the blink, or you were in a dead area.
Jimmy had indeed been in a dead area. That was, he was in a pub with his mobile switched off.
Well, let's get going and see if Crumb is at home, said Jimmy. I haven't told Blair what we're up to, because there may be nothing in it, and I don't feel like pinching small-time villains today.
Fatty lived in Atlee Towers. What on earth were the town planners thinking of when they had these monsters thrown up to be filled with the scum of the earth? Their children vandalised the lifts, painted the walls with graffiti and shit in the passageways. Anyone with any claim to decency would have been driven out long ago. The tall tower building was full of the noise of the rising wind. As Hamish guessed, the lift was broken.
"What number?" asked Jimmy.
304, said Charlie.
"Here we go, then," said Jimmy. "You pair go and get him and bring him to headquarters for a wee chat."
"Haven't got a warrant to arrest him," said Hamish.
"Och, the climb up the stairs will do you good."
Jimmy groaned. He was a wiry, foxy-faced man who loathed exercise. He had reached the first landing when Charlie called.
"This is odd."
"What's odd?" asked Jimmy.
"Or do you plan to wait down there all day?"
"Usually the big numbers are up top, but here they're on the ground floor," said Charlie. "There's a board here, and you can just make it out under the graffiti."
"Great," said Jimmy. "Now, let's hope he's at home."
Jimmy was anxious to get the interview over with as soon as possible. He knew he should have kept Hamish and Charlie in Loch Doo and brought a detective instead. But Hamish in the past had, through his odd intuition, a way of seeing round corners. Fatty was at home. Charlie thought it was more like the lair of a junk food animal. His small living room was crammed with discarded wrappers and pizza boxes. Soft drink cans were lined up along the mantelpiece and spilled over onto the already cluttered floor. The smell was dreadful. Jimmy opened the window wide.
"I'll catch my death,"
whined Fatty. His real name was Chester Crumb, but his vast size earned him the nickname of Fatty. He had a round face and several chins. His sparse hair covered parts of a scruffy scalp. His clothes were stretched across his bulk.
"Now, Chester," began Jimmy, who had no intention in these PC days of using that nickname.
You never knew when people might be taping you on their smartphones.
"It has come to our attention that you have been peddling contraband goods in Cromish."
"I don't even know where that is," whined Fatty.
"You went into the village shop and sold a case of e-cigarettes, and we've got it on video."
"It was given to me," said Fatty righteously. "Man down at the docks, he says, 'Here you are, cigarettes, make yourself a bob.'"
"And what did this generous gentleman look like?" asked Hamish.
"Medium height, ordinary clothes. Looked like a seaman off one of the tankers. The eye had that bandy-legged walk."
"Come on," sneered Jimmy. "Do you expect us to believe this rubbish?"
"Unless it was right before the customs men were about to arrive," said Hamish. "That's right. They was all over the place, so I scarpered. I thought maybe I'd better try to sell the stuff as far away from Strathbane as I could. But man, e-cigarettes! It's the real ones folk want."
"They might be faulty," said Hamish. "I mean, I've never heard of really cheap e-cigarettes being sold in Europe."
"Wasn't there something in the paper about some e-cigarettes setting the place alight when you try to charge them?"
"Can you take a guess at the name of the ship the man might have come off?" asked Jimmy.
"Maybe it was
"'The Baltic Queen?' said Fatty. "'The one's the last ship's been in here. "'I mean, nothing much berths here.'
"'Keep your mouth shut about this, and we won't be charging you,' said Hamish quickly.
"'And why not charge him?'
demanded Jimmy when they left. "'Because it would all lead back to Sadie, and the poor widow would get a criminal record. "'Also, it might alert the real smugglers.'
"'I'll leave it for now. "'We'd best track down this Baltic Queen. "'Get back to your beat, Hamish, and don't come sniffing around here again.'
"'Ungrateful bastard,' said Hamish. "'I'm hungry again.' He stopped at a fish-and-chip shop and bought fish-and-chips for himself and Charlie, and haggis suppers for the dogs. They went up on the moors to eat in peace. The fickle Sutherland weather was changing again, heralded by three rainbows stretched across the flanks of the mountains.
"'It must be the only place in the British Isles where you can see three rainbows at once.'
"'Aye, it's a bonny sight,'
said Charlie, munching contentedly. Charlie was a good man, reflected Hamish, but sometimes he missed Dick. Dick had been a combination of camper and caterer. Every stop, and out would come the stove, the picnic table, and a supply of goodies. But Hamish's mood grew darker. What was it that Dick had that he did not? He blushed as he realized he had voiced his thoughts out loud.
"'Baps,' said Charlie. "'Congress cake, fairy cakes, fern cakes, you name it. "'That's Dick's passion, and Anka shares it down to the last crumb. "'An English pal of mine once said to me, "'I've got to bring back those Scottish rolls. "'What are they called? "'Baps, that's it. "'And it's like the days when folk used to say, "'Cheesecake isn't what it used to be. "'Everyone'll tell you that baps aren't what they used to be, "'except for Anka's. "'Imagine a poll showing the Scots how to bake.'
"'It's happening all over,' said Hamish. "'The South Koreans have just won the best baguette competition in Paris.' Charlie laughed.
"'Maybe that's what drove the poor prof to stop believing in God. You know, if there's a God, why can't I get a decent bap?'
Hamish sighed. "'We'd better get on.
"'I know. Let's try Handy. Surely an ex-copper, however high up, must have kept his nose for villains.'
But Handy was not at home. And neither was his sister.
"'Let's call on Sheila Haggis,' said Hamish. "'Maybe she's got some more tips.'
"'Look her there,' said Charlie. "'That's her just leaving.'
Hamish started to run. He was a champion hill runner, and soon caught up with Sheila as she was just letting in the clutch. She opened the car window.
"'What is it?' she demanded. "'I'm busy.'
Hamish told her what Olivia had said, and Sheila sneered.
"'And you believe that rubbish? Men!'
"'And what were you doing down at Maggie's?' asked Hamish.
"'You stupid man! I'd just gone for a walk along the river. Now get out of my way!'
She drove off just as Charlie came ambling up to join Hamish.
"'What's up?' he asked.
Hamish had a blind look in his hazel eyes. He focused on Charlie and said slowly, "'What would take a professor, a minister's daughter, and a classy beauty to Maggie's.
Drugs?
Could be. Hamish pushed back his cap and scratched his fiery hair.
Let's find out who's the doctor for this village. We'll ask Jock.
Jock volunteered that they had to go to a Dr. Farham in Brakey. Emergencies were dealt with by the ambulance service.
And a lot of folk here use the ambulance service, said Jock. "'Because when you phone for an appointment, you're told the wait is 3 weeks.'
"'So breaky it is,' said Charlie, as they drove off.
"'Are we going to call in on Dick?'
"'Why not?'
Dick and Anka had transformed their living quarters above the shop into offices. They had bought a house outside of the town. Hamish had found himself hoping that Anka might have become a wee bit dowdy. A phenomenon he had noticed before in married women. Not that Anka was married, but she and Dick had been together for some time now. But Anka, from her long legs to her auburn hair and green eyes, was as dazzling as ever. Ever since they had put their famous bakery items for sale online, they had done a brisk trade, employing girls to serve in the shop, and two youths to help cope with the orders on the computers.
Dick had kept a small room above the shop for visitors. He bustled about, making tea and bringing in a selection of cakes.
"I'll take some of your baps back with me for the hotel," said Charlie.
"No need for that," Dick grinned. "We supply them with breakfast baps. Big order. And if they need a special cake for someone's anniversary, we do that as well."
Hamish told Dick all about the case, while Dick folded his hands over his stomach and listened carefully. When Hamish had finished, Dick said,
"I think it might be drugs, but I'd leave the Baltic Queen alone. That was probably some daft East Europeans trying to peddle cheap Chinese e-cigarettes. Could be some of the dangerous ones that were once on the market. You try to charge them and your house goes on fire. Only an idiot would buy one now. Speaking of idiots, how's our friend Blair?"
At that moment, Detective Chief Inspector Blair was hanging out of his living room window, screaming,
"Help!"
A burly neighbour, whom Blair detested, climbed up a ladder, heaved Blair out, and carried him down in a fireman's lift, to cheers from the watching crowd. A fire engine raced up, followed by an ambulance and a police car. They would find out that the e-cigarette he had bought in a pub had gone up in flames when he had tried to charge it. It was his day off, and he had been stretched out on the sofa, fast asleep, only waking when he fell off the sofa in the middle of a nightmare and found the place ablaze. Mary, his wife, had been out shopping. He would need to put the blame on her, say she had bought it, or he would be damned for having been stupid enough to buy anything at all offered cheaply in a pub. With that decision, he pretended to faint. Hamish and Charlie waited patiently in Dr. Farham's waiting room. Hamish wondered if anything had been done to it during the last 100 years. The walls were painted institutional green, and the wood skirting dark brown. A black marble fireplace held dusty orange crepe paper. A sampler, with the legend, "His eye is on the sparrow," decorated one wall, and on the other was a steel engraving of John Knox preaching in St. Giles Cathedral to a distinctly tarty-looking Mary Queen of Scots. A grim-faced receptionist had told them they had to wait, with such force and venom that the two large policemen sat down in hard chairs like obedient children.
"She shouldn't dye her moustache blonde," whispered Charlie.
"Who?"
"The Gestapo at the desk," whispered Hamish. "It shows there's something up with her hormones. So go carefully, or she'll be chasing us down the street with a hypodermic needle."
Charlie let out a snort of laughter. The receptionist glared at him and said,
"There are ill people here, so kindly behave yourselves."
"This is Monday," whispered Hamish, "and this room is full of the society of the bad back. Turn up regular on Mondays. Oh, the last one's just gone in. Shouldn't be long now." At last, the final patient came out.
"Wait!"
ordered the receptionist. She disappeared into the surgery, and then emerged to say triumphantly,
"Doctor isn't able to see you. He's been called out on an urgent appointment."
She barred the door to the surgery. Hamish lifted her to one side as she screamed and yelled. He and Charlie walked in. Dr. Farham was taking a slug of something from a silver flask as they entered.
"Now, aren't you the bad man?"
said Hamish, as he and Charlie sat down in chairs on the other side of the desk.
"I'm tired," said the doctor, huffily.
He was a tall, thin man with a beaky nose and thick grey hair.
"I didn't know you were policemen. I told Miss Harricote that I could not see any more patients, as it was already well over time for the day's surgery. Harricote being the mean bean outside."
"If you mean my excellent receptionist, yes. So what brings you?"
"Can you tell me if you have been treating anyone from, say, Drim, for drug abuse?"
"Any patient's treatment is confidential."
"I can get a warrant," said Hamish, although he was sure he could not.
"Well, we'll have to wait until then. Good heavens, man, you should know a doctor cannot discuss his patients. How would you like it if I told the world you had AIDS?"
"And as I don't, it's all hypothetical," said Hamish. "I'll be back."
Dear me, the Highland answer to Arnold Schwarzenegger.
"Do you think we can get a warrant?" asked Charlie when they were outside.
On a hunch, not a hope. But we can bluff. Let's go and have a wee word with Sheila Haggis.
The mercurial weather of Sutherland had turned cold.
Lambing blizzard coming up, said Hamish. Always seems to hit just when you think spring is here to stay.
Aye, it's purple black out to the west, said Charlie. Let's get it over with. I don't want to be stuck in Drim for the night. The on place fair gies me the creeps.
Charlie, when we get to Drim, would you mind giving the dogs a run?
We'll stop on the road, said Charlie. I don't think you should see Sheila on your own. She could cry rape or something.
Hamish agreed. He waited impatiently after they had stopped halfway to let the dogs out, glancing uneasily at the blackening sky to the west. Anxious to get going, he whistled them back into the Land Rover and set off for Drim, just as the first flakes of snow came hurling across the windscreen. By the time they had pulled up outside the manse, the snow was thick on the ground.
"How are you going to approach it?"
asked Charlie, as Hamish rang the doorbell.
"In the good old Highland way," said Hamish. "Lie through my teeth."
The door swung open, and Sheila stood there.
"Come in," she said. "What brings you? In fact, if you haven't arrested that bitch yet, I really don't think I have the time to speak to you."
"Oh, this'll interest you," said Hamish.
"Well, stop looming over me and come through to the kitchen. There's a good fire in the Raeburn."
They took off their caps and followed her. To Hamish's surprise, it was a friendly, cheerful contrast with the rest of the gloomy manse. An old Welsh dresser, filled with Crown Derby plates, decorated one wall. Another held bookshelves of cookery books. And then there were shelves of everyday crockery.
"Tea?"
offered Sheila.
"No, thank you, Miss Haggis. We have just been on a visit to Dr. Farham."
She turned round to lift the kettle onto the stove.
"So?"
"Good man for treating the drug addicts," said Hamish.
She swung round again and looked at him defiantly.
"I'm better. Been there, done that. I run a therapy group at Brakey Hospital on Thursdays, but I bet he didn't tell you that."
"I want to know this time," said Hamish. "Were you, perhaps, spying on Maggie's?"
She sighed and sat down at the table and waved a small red hand to indicate they should do the same.
"I was in Inverness shopping and remembered one of the women in my group saying she had got her drugs from a grimy cafe on Ness Bank. I went to have a look. That's when I saw Olivia with that professor."
"Why didn't you tell us about the drugs afore?" asked Charlie.
"I didn't know about it until last Thursday, that's why."
"We'll need to take a statement from this woman."
"I have to protect her anonymity. I will make a statement."
"Right," said Hamish, taking out a tape recorder, while Charlie tugged a notebook out of his pocket.
"I think we might have that tea after all. I'll take the statement back to Loch Doo and type it up and bring it back for you to sign, unless you've got a computer and printer here."
Sheila put cups, sugar and milk, and a fat teapot on the table, along with a plate of scones.
"No," she said, "this is dinosaur land."
"Before we get all official," said Hamish, "and do try to put aside your dislike of Olivia Sinclair, you must know all the signs of drug-taking. Did you notice any on Mrs. Sinclair?"
She shook her head.
"But I don't believe all that rubbish about the professor being there by chance."
Hamish recorded her statement, and promised to return as soon as possible to get her to sign it. Hamish suddenly stared at her, his eyes vacant and his mouth slightly open.
"What am I thinking about, wasting time talking to the village idiot?" she thought with sudden impatience.
Hamish stood up abruptly. "We've got to rush," he said, and, followed by a startled Charlie, he sped out of the manse.
"What's up?"
demanded Charlie, climbing into the passenger seat.
"I'd barely got my teeth into one of her scones, and I had to put it back with a bite mark on it."
"You should have taken it with you. Listen, we've got to find out if the prof was filmed by Strathbane Television when he was speaking. Maybe the cameras panned over the audience. I'd like to see if Olivia was there."
Charlie shifted uncomfortably. He still saw Olivia as very attractive.
"We'd better tell Jimmy," Hamish said. "You phone him and tell him to meet us at the television offices."
"Do you think we'll get through this blizzard?"
"We can try,"
said Hamish. "I think it's thinning a bit."
By the time they reached the television offices, it was to find Jimmy pacing up and down outside. Watery sunlight was melting snow from the roofs.
"Snow," said Hamish curtly. "So what's all this about?"
asked Jimmy. Hamish told him, and added that it might be an idea to tell Inverness to raid Maggie's for drugs.
"I have a tape recording of Sheila's statement. Once we're finished here, I'll type it up at headquarters and take it back for her to sign."
"Why isn't our friend Blair muscling in on this?" asked Charlie.
Jimmy grinned.
"His flat went on fire. He's in hospital with burns on his fat back. Says he doesn't know how it started, but Cully, the informant, saw Blair buying an e-cigarette in the pub, and it could have been one of those ones that bursts into flames when you charge them."
"So has the wife anywhere to live?"
"Nearly didn't. The fat one hadn't paid the insurance, so no temporary flat was on offer, and he'll need to pay for all the repairs. So Mrs. Daviot has offered them house room."
"What a laugh. Blair won't be able to get drunk."
"Okay, let's see what we can find here."
They were ushered from one place to another until they were finally conducted into the office of Dermot Lancey, who had produced the documentary on the professor. He was a big, shaggy man dressed like a lumberjack in a checked shirt and faded jeans. He had greasy black curls down to his shoulders and a black matted beard.
"Aye, I remember the wee tosser," he said. "Told him after the show what a scunner he was. You can take your lousy views and shove them up your scrawny arse," I told him.
"You are a good Christian, Mr. Lancey," commented Hamish.
"What, me? No. Look, this God business comforts a lot of folk, right? Why take it away? I didn't go round at Christmas grabbing hold of bairns and saying, 'There is no Santa Claus.' If you follow me to the studio, we'll run through what I've got. I've got shots of the audience in Inverness and here in Strathbane as well."
In the studio, they leaned forward in their chairs as the camera panned over the audience. There was nothing of interest in the brief shots of the Strathbane audience, but it was when it moved to Inverness that they struck gold. There, in the front row, was none other than Olivia Sinclair. Jimmy agreed that Hamish and Charlie should go back and interview her again to find out why she had said nothing about going to hear the professor speak. On the road back, Hamish said he would leave the dogs at the police station and then they could be on their way. The snow had melted fast, and sunlight shining on the puddles of the road turned them into little lakes of molten gold. Charlie was excited at the thought of seeing Olivia again. He reminded himself that she was a married woman, but the frissons of excitement would not seem to go away. There was an ice chest on the doorstep, with a label addressed to Charlie.
"Be careful," cautioned Hamish. "Could be something nasty."
"No, it's from my cousin Hugh. Of course he'd think I was living here."
Charlie carried the chest inside and set it on the table. When he opened it and examined the contents, he let out a whoop of delight.
"What is it?" asked Hamish. "It's pickled googa, crappit heed, and carrageen pudding."
Hamish knew that he meant baby gannet, stuffed cod's head, and seaweed pudding.
"I warned you it might be something nasty," said Hamish. "You have no taste," said Charlie huffily. "This is a banquet for kings."
"Never mind. We'll drop your goodies off at the castle and be on our way. Give it to Clary to put in one of the kitchen fridges, and ask him if we can bum a couple of sandwiches."
Charlie emerged a short time later from the hotel kitchen door with a wicker hamper.
"We're in luck," he crowed. "One picnic hamper left over."
They stopped by a burn before they reached Olivia's home. The hamper contained not only sandwiches, but a thermos of coffee. They ate and drank contentedly until Hamish said, "I might have an idea to get to her before her husband comes home."
"Oh, aye," said Charlie. "I keep forgetting about him."
Hamish looked at him sharply.
"Not keen on her, are you?" "Me? No."
And Charlie crossed his fingers behind his back. People never think of policemen as dreamers. But if they did not have some sort of fantasy life to counteract the horrors of their job, they might go bonkers. So it was that Charlie remembered the glorious feast, and suddenly saw himself entertaining Olivia to dinner. His dream nearly died when Olivia did not look particularly pleased to see them. She was even less pleased when Hamish explained the reason for their visit.
"I didn't think it important.
There's nothing much else to do up here but go and watch a freak show.
But when he, as you said, approached you in Maggie's, you told us nothing about having already seen him.
All right, she shouted, clutching her hair. I talked to him after the show. He was awfully boring, that's all. I was ashamed of having been to a gig like that. I mean, I don't give a monkey's tail about God one way or the other.
Did you know that there's a good possibility of drugs being sold at Maggie's?
No, I did not. Enough. I'm not answering any more questions without my lawyer.
Outside, Hamish said. Got that on the recorder?
I've left it behind.
Charlie rushed back into the house in time to see Olivia picking up the small tape recorder.
I'll take that, he said, seizing it.
She suddenly fell into his arms and burst into tears.
I'm frightened of my husband finding out I went to that lecture, she sobbed. Why do you think he leaves me stuck out here? He's madly possessive.
One thin white hand, with long red nails, clutched at his regulation sweater.
I shouldn't have said that about a lawyer, should I?
Well, no, said Charlie, awkwardly. Makes you look guilty.
Why don't we talk it over, say, this evening? Come to my wee place at the castle for dinner, you and your husband.
Her tears dried as if by magic. It was like watching a film played backwards.
You are so good, she breathed. What time?
8 o'clock.
We'll be there.
Charlie decided not to tell Hamish about his invitation. Hamish would lecture him. But he had invited the husband as well, so all was correct. Charlie did not like the way Hamish had jeered at the delicacies of the Hebrides. On the road back, he sat wrapped in a happy dream of how Olivia's beautiful eyes would widen when she saw the banquet. That evening, Charlie was glad that the Colonel and his wife were off visiting friends, because he was sure George would have tried to butt in. He was so happy in his little home that he rarely broke anything. A peat fire warmed the living room. The table was laid with a white cloth pinched from the dining room. A bottle of Chablis was chilling in an ice bucket in the pantry. The room was lit by one standard lamp, casting a golden glow on the crystal glasses on the table. Charlie had brushed his fair hair until it shone. He was wearing a blue linen shirt over dark blue cords. Exactly at 8 o'clock, he heard footsteps descending the stone stairs to his basement. Olivia entered. She was alone.
"Where is Mr. Sinclair?" asked Charlie.
"Oh, he had work to do. Help me off with my coat."
Olivia was wearing a mink coat. When Charlie removed it, he saw she had on a skimpy little black dress with a plunging neckline and a very short skirt.
"We should be chaperoned," said Charlie.
"Oh, you adorable bear. I'm not going to seduce you."
Charlie blushed and shuffled his feet, but he could not bear to give up sharing the glory of these delicacies.
"Take a seat," he said.
He brought the wine and poured two glasses. Then he said,
"Now, this is a real Hebridean delicacy."
He went out to what had been the old butler's pantry and came back with plates containing slices of pickled gouga and salad. Olivia took a first mouthful. It was, she thought, like chewing salted rubber.
"What on earth is this?" she demanded.
"It's gouga," said Charlie proudly, "and you'll never guess what's to follow."
"What? Crap it heed.
Do you mean to say there is actually a dish which sounds as if it is a head that someone has crapped in?"
"It is the cod's head stuffed with oatmeal," said Charlie desperately.
"And there's carrageen pudding for afters."
Olivia rose to her feet, knocking her chair backwards in her haste.
"You're quite right. I shouldn't have come. Help me on with my coat. Oh, don't just stand there with your mouth open."
Silently he helped her into her coat and followed her upstairs. In the reception area, Olivia turned and faced him.
"Did you really expect me to eat that peasant muck?"
And Charlie, regrettably, lost his temper.
"Shove off afore I strangle you, you rotten bitch!" he yelled.
The manager, Mr. Johnson, came out of his office. People spilled out of the bar as Olivia stalked out to her car.
"Into my office, Charlie," ordered Mr. Johnson.
He ushered Charlie in and shut the door. "Now,
What are you doing creating a scene like that?
Charlie hung his head and blurted out the whole story, while the manager tried not to laugh. At last, Mr. Johnson said,
Just don't ever throw a scene like that again.
Isn't there anyone from the islands on the staff that might like a bit?
Not unless they eat things like that in Poland. And anyone in Loch Dhu will have eaten the evening meal around 6 o'clock. It's still high tea in Loch Dhu. There's old Lady Cranach in the dining room. She's from Uist.
Charlie shot out before Mr. Johnson could stop him. By the time he had chased Charlie into the dining room, the tall policeman was bending over Lady Cranach and talking rapidly.
"Go away, Charlie," said Mr. Johnson. "M'lady, I must apologise. Out of my way! This young man is taking me to dinner."
Lady Cranach put one old, gnarled hand on Charlie's arm, and together they walked out of the dining room. Charlie's dinner was a success at last. Lady Cranach ate every bit of Guga, declared the crapit heed divine, and entertained Charlie with tales of South Uist in the old days. She said that she came to the hotel every year to be looked after.
How old was she? Charlie wondered.
Her face was brown and covered in a criss-cross of wrinkles. Her small black eyes were bright with intelligence. But, he realised, when she had finished most of the wine, there was not often such a thing as a sweet old lady, as he removed her heavily ringed hand from his knee for the fourth time. When he had finally escorted her upstairs and said good night, he found his conscience was hurting him. Hamish would no doubt hear about the scene with Olivia. How could he have been so stupid? He could not begin to imagine the horror that was to descend on him. Chapter 5. Marriage is like life in this, that it is a field of battle and not a bed of roses. Robert Louis Stevenson. Ailsa, Jock's red-haired wife, was stacking up crates of empty bottles at the back of the store. She stopped her work to admire a pair of buzzards sailing up against a clear blue sky, and wondered if they might be in for a spell of good weather at last. She saw villager Edie Aubrey and waved to her.
"You'll never believe it," panted Edie, running up to join Ailsa.
"Believe what?" asked Ailsa, thinking that Edie was a bit like an eager dog, her brown eyes gleaming under a heavy fringe.
"Jimmy Loughlin, him what helps out in the kitchen at the Tomal Castle. Well, he says there was such a stramash there last night. It was on Big Loon of a Copper, Charlie something, and Olivia Sinclair."
"Go on."
"They came up from the basement, and he shouts that he's going to kill her. My, my, I wish he would kill the bitch. Last time she came in the shop and spoke to Jock, she leaned over the counter, and her neckline was so low he could see her tits. And she's got the minister not knowing whether he's coming or going." "The ghosts have gone quiet anyway," said Edie. "Must have been smuggler folk."
"They can't have come up the loch," said Ailsa. "I mean, folk would have heard a boat. Oh, talking of Olivia, isn't that madam over there?"
"Where?"
"Up by the castle, sitting on that rock. She's bent over, looking at something on the ground, but I recognise that mink coat."
"Like a coffee? Jock's caved in and bought one of the new machines."
"Aye, that would be grand."
"It's too fine a day to go inside. Sit down on a crate and I'll bring it out to you. It's milk and two sugars."
"Aye."
Edie turned her face up to the sun. Somehow, despite the murder of the professor, fear had left Drim. Smugglers were of this earth, not like ghosts. Ailsa soon returned and handed her a mug of coffee.
"Try that, Edie. Better than that instant muck. I was just saying to Jock the other day, look at that. She's still crouched over."
"Olivia?"
"Aye, herself. Oh, damn it to hell, I'd better go and make sure she isn't ill."
As Ailsa approached the still figure, she had a sudden feeling of dread. It was early in the morning, and Olivia's coat sparkled with dew.
"Olivia?"
she shouted. She put a hand on her shoulder. No reaction. Ailsa walked round the rock and peered up into Olivia's face. That face was clay white.
"You are ill. Come on, up you get."
She slid her strong arms inside Olivia's coat and tried to lift her. That was when Olivia's head tilted back, and Ailsa saw the cruel red marks on her neck. She ran back, shouting to Edie,
"She's dead!
"Murdered! Dead! Don't just stand there! Dead! Dead! Dead!"
Hamish received the news just after Charlie had joined him in the police station.
"I'll phone Jimmy," said Hamish. "I suppose we are the ones who'll have to break the news to the husband."
"Why, Charlie, man, you're as white as a sheet." "I was with her yesterday evening," said Charlie.
"You what? Why?"
"It was the Googa and stuff. I told her about it when I went back for the tape recorder. On impulse, I invited her and her husband to dinner. She turned up alone."
"I can see from your face, Charlie, that there's worse to come. Out with it."
"She sneered at the food and stomped out. In reception, she called it peasant muck, and I felt she was insulting my whole heritage. I shouted at her. I threatened to strangle her. Mr. Johnson heard me, and some of the guests as well."
"She was strangled, Charlie. What happened after that?"
"There was this old biddy, Lady Cranach from Uist, and I invited her, and she loved every bit of it."
"So that takes us up to what time?"
"About 11:30.
"So let's hope forensics find she was killed afore then. But police headquarters are going to find out about you living at the hotel unless we can stop it. Now, your friend Colonel Halberton Smythe is always anxious to play the great detective. Get on the phone and ask him to help you with an excuse."
While Charlie went outside to phone, Hamish called Jimmy and told him all about Olivia's visit to the hotel and how Charlie had been heard threatening her. Hamish ended up by saying, "You know Charlie's got a wee flat at the hotel. Try to keep that quiet." Hamish could hear Jimmy roaring with laughter.
"What's so bloody funny?"
"I was just thinking," gasped Jimmy, "of a sophisticated bitch like Olivia Sinclair, star of Hunt Balls and other snobby events, being faced with a pickled seagull."
"Will you tell the husband or shall I?" demanded Hamish.
"You do it. Tell Charlie he's off the case and to sit tight. I would tell you to leave it to Tane Police, but I'd like you to size up his reaction. We're Police Scotland and just the one big happy family, so if anyone over there objects, tell them that."
Hamish rang off just as Charlie came back in.
"You're suspended, Charlie, but we'll get you off the hook as soon as possible."
"Is it all right if I go to see George? He's sure he can fix things."
"Well, I hope the Colonel can do something. Off with you, and look after the dogs."
Hamish drove out, noticing the weather had turned colder. The remains of the snow had frozen into surrealist bars across the moors. A sign that the day was to remain dry and fine lay in the mountains, which appeared to have taken a step backwards. When rain was coming, they appeared to crowd closer, every crevice and gully in sharp relief, as on a steel engraving. He sighed. Olivia must have been trying to fascinate Charlie so that he would tell her everything about the case. Why? What had she to hide? Hamish had judged her to be highly manipulative. And what had she been doing on a rock near the castle? Ailsa said there was dew on her coat. That would mean she had been there early in the morning. No, wait a bit. If it turned colder, then dew, which was just condensation, could form during the night. So say she had phoned someone from her car after leaving Charlie, and that someone had suggested a meet in Drim. The road to Tane took him past the Sinclair's home. He had just left it behind when he saw a Range Rover speeding in the opposite direction, with Selwyn Sinclair at the wheel. Hamish did a U-turn and put on the siren and the blue light. In front of him, Selwyn screeched to a halt. Hamish got down from the Land Rover, and Selwyn, in front of him, got out of his car.
"I'm right sorry, sir," began Hamish. "Well, I'm sorry, I was speeding, officer. Can't we let it go this time?"
Hamish, who had assumed the grieving husband had heard the news of his wife's murder and was heading for either home or Drim, realised he had not yet learned of her death. Removing his cap and tucking it under his arm, Hamish said,
"I am afraid I have bad news for you, sir."
"What bad news?"
"Your wife was murdered, maybe last night, sir. Her body was found at Drim."
Selwyn's reaction startled Hamish.
"Stupid bitch," said Selwyn. "What the hell was she up to this time?"
"Perhaps," suggested Hamish soothingly, "we could go to your house, and you can tell me, as you did not know about your wife's death, what you were doing racing home."
Selwyn gave a curt nod, and walked back to his car.
"Uncomfortable house," thought Hamish, as he waited for Selwyn to get out of his outdoor clothes. "You'd think the photographers from House and Garden would be arriving any moment. Bet you it was done by an interior decorator."
He was puzzled by Selwyn's behaviour. Surely a man who had just been told his wife had been murdered wouldn't delay by changing out of his outdoor clothes. He finally reappeared, with a dry martini in one hand and a cigarette in the other. He had taken off not only his coat, but his business suit as well, and was wearing jeans and a sweater. He had one of those smooth gin and sauna faces with a large curved nose over a small mouth. His fair hair was brushed flat against his skull, and his eyes were dark grey.
"Sit down," he ordered. "Now, out with it."
"Your wife, Olivia Sinclair, was found in Drim this morning. She had been strangled. At first estimate, it looks as if she might have been killed during the night. Where were you last night, sir?"
"I was here, in bed."
"And did you see your wife at any time?"
"No, we have separate bedrooms. I did not check hers. I had a long day's work and went straight to bed. I had dinner with some Japanese businessman at the Caledonian in Inverness, and did not get back here until after midnight. I stopped outside Inverness for petrol, and I have a receipt. Also the bill for the dinner."
"Why would your wife have gone to Drim? We're not yet sure of the time of death. But why would she go there in any case?"
"To screw up someone's life, I assume. What a damn mistake I made getting married to her."
Hamish could hear the sound of approaching sirens. Jimmy would not butt in, but Blair would.
"I think that is my superior officer," said Hamish.
To Selwyn's surprise, Hamish disappeared into the back of the house, just as there came a hammering at the front door. Selwyn opened it to find himself confronted by Detective Chief Inspector Blair, his hairy hands still bandaged up. He was accompanied by a female detective and a police sergeant.
"Mr. Selwyn Sinclair," said Blair, "you are to accompany us to police headquarters in Strathbane for questioning."
"I'm going for a pee first," said Selwyn.
Once in the bathroom, he phoned Superintendent Daviot.
"What the hell is this man Blair doing, Peter?" he raged. "My wife has just been murdered, and the fool is trying to drag me off in handcuffs."
"Put him on the phone now," said Daviot. "This is dreadful."
Selwyn emerged from the bathroom to find Blair standing outside.
"Superintendent Daviot wants a word with you," he said.
Blair gingerly took the proffered mobile. The phone clacked busily. Blair finally handed it back to Selwyn, his face scarlet.
"I hope you've told the fool to take a run and jump," Blair heard Selwyn say. "Before he turned up, I was being correctly and professionally interviewed by a copper named Macbeth. If you want more out of me, get him back."
As he drove off, Blair cursed and fumed. Somehow he would prove Selwyn Sinclair guilty of murder, and he was prepared to bribe for information and fake evidence, if that's what it took. Hamish's radio sprang into life, with the voice of Daviot ordering him to take over the questioning of Selwyn. Once again, as he drove back, Hamish marvelled at the way Blair kept his job, but he always crawled to Daviot. No one else did, apart from Secretary Helen. And Daviot was fundamentally a weak man. Still, if Blair found out about Charlie staying at the castle, he would have ammunition. Daviot was pleasantly surprised to receive a phone call from Colonel Halberton Smythe.
"I was wondering," said the Colonel, "if you and Mrs. Daviot would care to be my guests for dinner tonight. I have a little problem, and would be glad of your advice."
"We are delighted to accept," said Daviot. "What time?"
"Say 8 o'clock," said the Colonel.
"Splendid! I will do all I can to help you with your problem."
After he had rung off, Daviot phoned his wife to tell her about the dinner invitation.
"Oh, what'll I wear?" she shrieked. "I'll need to buy a new gown."
"Oh, do what you want," said the super expansively.
To Daviot and his friends at the lodge,
Tomal Castle Hotel was the equivalent of Claridge's in London, and the Halberton Smythes were considered the local aristocracy. Perhaps their friends, Lord and Lady Caithness, might be there. So Blair was lucky when he crept in later to fulsomely apologise, and was merely told that his burns must still be hurting and affecting his judgment, and to take 2 days off. Back in Selwyn's living room, Hamish said cautiously, "You do not seem particularly distressed about the death of your wife."
"No, I am not. It'll spare me the expense of the divorce she was trying not to give me."
"So who is the next Mrs. Sinclair going to be?"
"What on earth gave you that stupid idea?" yelled Selwyn. "I've had enough of bloody women."
"I do apologise," said Hamish meekly. "It's just that love for someone else often prompts a divorce."
"May I ask, sir, why you obviously did not like her? You see, the more I know about her, the better chance I have of understanding her character. If I feel I know the person, it helps me find out who might have murdered them."
"I see what you're after. Well, Olivia was one chief manipulator. She liked finding out about people, so she could make them twist and turn in her claws. Small example. I had a pretty secretary 3 months ago. She got drunk at a hen party and did a bit of a striptease, not the lot, just stood on a table and waved her knickers in the air. Somehow, Olivia was there and videoed the whole thing and put it out on social media. That poor girl not only fled from the job, but from the Highlands as well. Why did I marry Olivia in the first place? She promised so many delights of sex, and yet was so clever about it that the first time I really had her was on our honeymoon. It was like shagging a corpse. I suppose I'd better identify the body."
"Did Mrs. Sinclair not have any family?"
"No, she was an only child. If she had any relatives, I never heard of them. A friend of hers acted as bridesmaid. What was her name? Droopy creature. Bethany Pollock, that's it. I'll have the address somewhere. Lives in Perth."
Hamish phoned ahead to make sure that the body had been moved to the mortuary in Strathbane. Selwyn said he would use his own car, and so they met outside the mortuary and walked in together. After Selwyn had identified the body of his wife, Hamish stayed behind and said to the mortuary technician,
"If you've got the professor here, may I have a look at him?"
"Sure, Mac. Got him out here, still in the slab. His sister, Miss Alice Gordon, is due any minute."
"What's the official cause of death?"
"Broken neck, maybe. But with him being bashed around the sea and the little fishies dining off the soft parts, it's hard to tell. Tried to put the sister off, but she would insist on coming."
He tilted his head to one side. Hamish noticed he had very small, very pointed ears. The old people would damn him as a changeling, that is, when the fairies snatch a baby and leave one of their own in its place.
"I bet that's her now."
The door opened, and a policewoman entered, with a small, thick-set woman, wearing an old-fashioned musquash coat with large furry buttons. She was wearing a matching fur hat, pulled down low on her forehead. Her eyes were small and brown. She looked like an outraged animal, disturbed during hibernation.
"Where is my brother?" she demanded.
The technician indicated a slab on the right, and gently rolled back the sheet from the face.
"That is he," she declared majestically. "I wish him to be cremated. He didn't believe in hellfire, but just in case it is real, it might be nice to give him a foretaste."
And with that, she burst out laughing. When she finally stopped, Hamish said, "I will take you to the Procurator Fiscal's office, so they may tell you when the body is to be released." When he had finally finished with her, he went to police headquarters to type up his report on Selwyn Sinclair. Jimmy Anderson came and leaned over his shoulder.
"Anything?"
Hamish looked round at him.
"If you die, Jimmy, I should be right sorry."
"This is so sudden, old fruit. What brought this on?"
Hamish told him about Selwyn's hatred for his wife, and about the professor's sister, howling with laughter.
"I've got 3 ex-wives who'd probably dance on my grave," said Jimmy.
"Cheer up, Hamish. I've got a sister who loves me."
Suddenly, Blair, followed by Daviot, erupted into the room.
"We've got them!" shouted Daviot. "The smugglers! They were wrecked off the west coast, and the Coast Guard got them with a cargo of cigarettes. Real ones! And one of them's got plans of that room under the tower and the passage. Murder solved!"
As Daviot triumphantly crowed over the arrest, Hamish felt uneasy. Vicious drug smugglers, he could understand. But was trade in contraband cigarettes enough to kill two people?
"Who are they?" Jimmy demanded. "They're a gang of teenagers from Glasgow who call themselves the Springburn Boys. Ringleader is one Creepy Jesus, real name John Torrance."
"So what's with the Creepy Jesus name?" asked Jimmy.
"Found God when he was once in a young offenders institution. Got the nickname there, and it stuck."
"How many in this gang?" asked Hamish.
5.
"And which one is the expert skipper?"
"Turns out, according to the Coast Guard, they didn't know one end of a boat from the other. Stole the boat in Strathbane, seen sailing erratically, and then got too near the cliffs and the boat began to smash up. Coast Guard had to call in air sea rescue because they couldn't get close enough to lift them off."
"And they've confessed to the murders?"
"Really, Macbeth, you are slowing up everything with all these questions. Get back to your beat."
Jimmy followed Hamish out. "You should be glad of the news. Let's your chum off the hook."
"I wish I could be in on the interviews," said Hamish.
"Look, if you've got 5 of them all saying yes to smuggling and no to murder, you won't have much to take to court. A sympathetic jury will let them off on the smuggling charge. I mean, cigarettes. If I were their lawyer, I'd be searching for smokers on the jury."
"I don't get it," said Jimmy. "You like lazing around the village and avoiding promotion. So what's the big fat hairy deal? Case solved."
"I don't think it is," said Hamish stubbornly.
"Well, if you find anything, my bonny heelin' laddie, don't tell me. I'm off to the pub."
Hamish drove slowly back to Loch Doo, his mind racing. 2 murders on his beat, and he was sure the young smugglers had nothing to do with it. When he got to the station, he phoned Charlie with the news, ending with, "I'm sure the murderer is still out there, but it lets you off the hook for the time being."
"Should I cancel that dinner? George has invited the Daviots."
"No, let them come. Daviot'll be so impressed that he won't want to hear anything against you. But don't go to the dinner yourself. Daviot's a snob. Come here instead and bring the dogs. I'll make supper."
Hamish looked at the phone after he had rung off, trying to remember if he knew anyone sympathetic in Glasgow. Then he remembered Rowan Southey. He hailed originally from the Black Isle, and knew Hamish and some of the Macbeth family. He looked up a battered old notebook, full of addresses and numbers he had kept meaning to transfer to his iPad and never got around to. He tried Strathclyde Police, but was told Rowan was off ill. He phoned his home number, and Rowan himself answered the phone. After he had reintroduced himself, Hamish said, "You're on sick leave. What's up with you?"
"Aye, it's a bad terminal illness called Police Scotland. Had to get off to go to an interview in London. Big security firm, bodyguard job. Big money. Took it. Can't wait until the morrow when I can tell them where to put their forms and targets and you name it right up their..."
"I get the picture." "Could you find out something afore you go?" asked Hamish.
"What?"
"We've just arrested a gang of smugglers for murder, led by a cheel called Creepy Jesus."
"Ah, pull the other one, Mac. Creepy Jesus is all wind and piss. He couldn't say booty a goose."
"What's he usually been done for?"
"Petty theft, drunken disorderly, peddling cigarettes. Nobody bothered about the cigs. I mean, gangs go out to wherever in the world is the cheapest and bring them back by the truckload. Then they hand them out to the lesser gangs to sell to the shops and a few cartons to people like Creepy to push in pubs. Mind you, they're catching a lot of the trucks now. Heard they was coming in by boat. So maybe Creepy, who'd always got big ideas off of the films, decided to cut out the middlemen and go get the fags himself. I'm telling you, Hamish, those lads are safer off in jail, because the big boys were bringing drugs as well. Someone tried to pocket a bit of money for themselves, and you didn't want to hear what happened to them afore they threw the carcass in the Clyde."
Hamish thanked him and rang off. He was about to switch on the computer and type up Selwyn's statement, as Strathbane would like it, all angles covered, although nothing would make them change their minds, when he decided the best thing he could do was forget about the whole thing for one evening. Hamish changed out of his uniform into comfortable shabby clothes, and walked along to Patel's grocery. God bless Asians, he thought, not for the first time. Mr. Patel now seemed to stock everything anyone could want, and had opened up a butcher's counter to sell local meat and fish. Hamish decided a big fry-up would suit them both, and bought haggis, venison sausages, eggs, bacon, mushrooms, tomatoes, and two slices of dumpling. Charlie arrived an hour later to find Hamish standing turning things in an enormous frying pan. Soon they sat down to an enormous supper, washed down with beer.
"I hope George is enjoying his dinner as much as I'm loving this," said Charlie.
But later that evening, George, Colonel Halberton Smythe, was beginning to become seriously alarmed, for he had praised Charlie so much that finally Daviot, warmed with fine food, wine and snobbery, said expansively,
"It's time he was promoted. I'll move him straight to Strathbane."
The colonel thought so hard he could feel a headache coming on.
"Peter," he said at last, "may I call you Peter?"
"Of course," said Daviot, beaming with gratification.
"It's like this. I must swear you both to secrecy."
"Certainly,"
both breathed in uniform.
"Charlie is the illegitimate son of the Kerensey family."
"You mean Lord Kerensey?"
asked Mrs. Daviot, eyes goggling.
"Shh," implored the colonel. "He was given to a Mrs. Carter out in Uist to bring up as her own. That is why I allowed Charlie a wee apartment here to look after him. He's too big for the police station, and he's young, so he is better here in Loch Doo, where I can keep an eye on him. But this secret is to be kept just between us."
The Daviots were flooded with gratification, and the colonel, who knew his wife was due back late that evening, hoped to get rid of the Daviots before she arrived. When his visitors had gone, the little colonel scampered down the stairs to tell Charlie the good news. Charlie was just about to go to bed, but listened eagerly as George explained that there would be no trouble about his staying at the castle from that day on. Charlie heard him out, and then said bitterly,
"So I'm supposed to thank you for calling me a bastard? My poor mother would turn in her grave if she could have heard you. You can keep your damn flat. I'm off to the station."
It showed how desperate the colonel was when he cried,
"Get Hamish here. He'll understand."
And Charlie, who felt that George deserved a real lecture, phoned Hamish and asked him to come as quickly as he could. They sat in silence, on either side of the fire. George was frightened of losing the only real friend he had ever had. His father had made a lot of money out of shoe shops, and so young George had been sent to public school and then Sandhurst Military Academy, where he had adopted a sort of military stage persona to cover his fears of not fitting in. Hamish arrived and listened to the colonel's tale of his lies to the Daviots and tried very hard not to laugh. When the colonel had finished, Hamish said,
"But why such an elaborate story?" "It was when I realized I had praised Charlie too much that Daviot said he would move him to Strathbane."
"You didn't tell me that bit," said Charlie. "I was concentrating so hard on finding a way to let you stay on in this flat."
"Look," said Hamish, "leave it to me. I know how to restore your honour, Charlie, and get you off the hook, Colonel."
"How?"
they both chorused. Hamish grinned. "Listen and learn." He dialed Daviot's home number. Daviot was still awake, having a nightcap with his wife, while they mulled over the success of the evening.
"You'd better have a good excuse for phoning this number, Macbeth," said Daviot.
Hamish's voice took on the crooning Highland lilt it always adopted when he was about to tell one whopping lie.
"It is like this, sir. Colonel Halberton Smythe told you that Charlie Carter was illegitimate.
In confidence, may I remind you.
But that is not true, and the Colonel is upset. He was frightened of losing Charlie to Strathbane, and he so valued your acquaintance that he made up the first thing that came into his head. You see, Carter is too big to fit into the police station, and a posh hotel like Tomal Castle is always being plagued with petty thieves and such. So if you don't mind Charlie staying on, the Colonel is anxious to apologise to you in person, and his wife is anxious to meet you. He suggests another evening, say, next Wednesday.
And David, who had just begun to think that Hamish was making a fool of him as usual, forgot his suspicions at the sound of Mrs. Halberton Smythe's name, for the Halbertons were aristocracy. Perhaps the Colonel's wife could put a word in for him at the palace. Sir Peter Daviot. He could hear it. He could feel the royal sword on his shoulder.
Sir? Demanded Hamish, wondering if the line had gone dead.
What? Oh, yes, my wife and I will be delighted to attend. Carter can stay.
But it all nearly came unstuck the following day. Daviot wanted to brag, and who better to brag to than Detective Chief Inspector Blair? Blair acted duly impressed, shaking his head in well-manufactured wonder, and saying,
"My, it's the palace for you next. Mind you, it would be right awful if Carter had been charging relocation money. I mean, he's only supposed to do that if we relocate him. Otherwise, he might have been claiming £8,000 for just going along the road after having claimed relocation expenses to Loch Doo."
Daviot summoned Helen.
"You may go, Blair," he snapped.
"I was only trying to help," said Blair, edging crabwise to the door.
"In your usual way," said Daviot bitterly.
When Blair had gone, he instructed Helen to find out about Charles Carter's expenses. Blair did not know it, but Daviot had started for the first time to think up ways of getting rid of him. For Daviot could not even bask in the glory of solved murders for worry that Carter had been cheating, and that his precious dinner would go up in smoke. His heart sank when Helen bustled in late that afternoon, saying,
"I'm afraid there is a problem with Constable Carter's expenses."
"What is it?"
"When he was transferred to Loch Doo, he forgot to claim any money for relocation."
The sun shone on the landscape of Daviot's mind once more.
"Inform the man to claim for the removal, Helen. Anything nice for tea?"
"I've got Empire biscuits."
"Wonderful."
Soon Daviot was crunching on two layers of biscuit with jam in the middle, and icing, and a cherry on top. He glared as Blair walked in unannounced.
"What is it?"
"I was just wondering about that.
If you mean Carter's relocation expenses, he didn't claim anything at all."
"Och, that is good news. My. Would that be an Empire biscuit?"
Daviot heard Helen arriving back outside. He rang the buzzer.
"Mr. Blair is leaving," he said icily.
"Aye, aye," Blair shuffled his feet. "See you at the lodge this evening."
But Daviot, his eyes once more full of dreams and his mouth full of biscuit, did not deign to reply. Chapter 6 Man is the only one to whom the torture and death of his fellow creatures is amusing in itself. James Anthony Froude. The next morning, Hamish felt spring had really arrived at last. A warm, frisky wind blew in from the west. As he strolled along the waterfront, his dogs at his heels, he longed to put his doubts to one side, forget about wrong people being accused of murder, and return to the lazy life he loved so much. He was accosted by the minister's wife. Mrs. Wellington never went outdoors without a hat. The latest number was like an Indiana Jones special, except that the hatband was decorated with a sprig of fake heather.
"I was looking at the ages of those murderers in the morning newspaper," she said. "All so young. What a waste of young lives."
She was joined by the Curry sisters, uniformly dressed in camel hair coats.
"Aye," said Nessie, "but it's a good thing we have the coast guard. because if it was left to this loon here, we wouldn't be safe in our beds. Safe in our beds, echoed the Greek chorus that was her sister.
Hamish hardly ever lost his temper, but all his worry about the case came up to the surface, and he shouted, "Och, shove off!" He strode off along the waterfront, with his dog scampering at his heels.
"I know just what to do about him," said Mrs. Wellington.
"Pray for him?" asked Nessie, echoed by her sister.
"No, that one needs a good strong woman to sort him out. I'll get my niece Heather Lomond to come on a wee visit. I'll have them married as soon as possible. She'll soon sort him out."
"He likes them pretty," warned Nessie.
"Handsome is as handsome does," said Mrs. Wellington,
who appeared to have a bottomless fund of clichés. Hamish saw Charlie strolling towards him, the policeman having decided to walk down from the castle. Hamish explained why he had just been rude to the Curry sisters and Mrs. Wellington.
"Aye, it bothers me as well," said Charlie. "A good lawyer could get them off. I mean, no one's found a murder weapon. They admitted using the tower basement to stock the stuff. Before, they had an expert skipper belonging to the Glasgow gang, them that set up the machinery to produce the wails and noises. Then the wee lads thought they'd cut out the middleman."
"I meant to ask," said Hamish. "I assume they found the machinery responsible for the hauntings."
"Yes, hidden up on top of the old tower and set on a timer. It was very cleverly concealed amongst the ivy, which is why they didn't find it first time."
"Let's go back to the station and go over the notes," said Hamish.
It was only when he was seated at his desk in the office that Hamish realized his folly in letting Charlie make coffee. The sound of breaking china sent him rushing to the kitchen. Red with mortification, Charlie was staring down miserably at two shattered coffee cups. Hamish looked at the broken shards and realized they were two cups bought by Christine that he had loathed. One bore the legend "Chauvinist Pig," and the other, "Women of the World Unite."
"It's all right," said Hamish soothingly. "Go into the living room and sit down with the dogs and watch something on TV."
"I'll replace them," said Charlie.
"Don't you dare. Off you go."
Hamish made coffee and poured some into another cup, also a relic of Christine. It bore the legend, "Men are good for nothing." He carried it in to Charlie.
"That's real decent of you," said Charlie with an expansive wave of his arm, which sent cup and contents flying onto the hearth,
where the cup shattered. Charlie leapt to his feet and banged his head on the ceiling and sank back on the sofa with a groan.
"I've got a grand idea," said Hamish. "You go out and take the dogs, and all of you get into the Land Rover. We'll drive up to the hotel and pay Clary to make us up coffee and sandwiches, and then we'll go somewhere quiet to sit and talk about the case. Off you go."
Hamish drove up to the Falls of Anstey. He was surprised to see that the recently derelict gift shop was now open again. It turned out to be owned and run by a Polish couple.
"Immigrants everywhere," grumbled Charlie as they sat on a flat rock above the falls.
"And thank goodness for that," said Hamish. "Where would the Highlands be without them? That gift shop has been closed for ages. No one else wanted to have it. Now, when we've finished eating, let's have a hard think about the murders."
The sun sparkled on the racing water. A balmy breeze blew in from the west. Fresh green leaves shivered on a stand of birch trees. When they had finished, Hamish raised his voice above the noise of the falls and said,
"We'd better find somewhere quieter."
They went back to where they had left the Land Rover in the gift shop car park, Hamish planning to have coffee at one of the tables outside, but a tour bus had just turned up. They got into the police car and headed further up onto the moors.
"That's George's Land Rover on the right. Oh, look, there's George fishing. It's a rare day for the fishing, Hamish."
Hamish stopped the car. "You're no good to me today. Off you go."
"Thanks. I'll get some trout for your dinner."
Hamish watched Charlie scamper off like a large schoolboy let out of school. He remembered wistfully the days when he could discuss cases with Priscilla, but there was no woman in his life now to listen to him. He did not know that, at that very moment, the minister's wife was planning to change that.
So, Heather, Mrs. Wellington was booming into an old-fashioned black phone, you've been a widow long enough. In this village, the local policeman needs someone to sort his life out. Why don't you come on a wee visit and see what you can do?
Once back at the station, Hamish remembered his friend, the doctor's wife, Angela Brodie. She had been of help to him in the past. He told the dogs to stay and took himself off along the waterfront to Angela's cottage. It was the only cottage with its back to the loch. It was a modern, ugly, grey building, built in the 1940s, to house the first doctor in the village. It fronted onto the road. You entered through a strip of garden at the back. Hamish called it a crofter's garden because it was full of bits of discarded machinery, witness to Angela's failed trials of electronic baking equipment from blenders to bread makers. In answer to his knock, Angela called, "Come in." Hamish walked into her messy kitchen. As usual, Angela was seated at the end of the cluttered kitchen table, scowling at a computer screen.
"How's the latest detective story going?" asked Hamish.
"I've stopped writing them."
"Why?"
"Can't compete with bestsellers like Stuart McBride, so why even try? I don't have his talent. I was talked into writing them. My forte is writing stuff damned as literary, which gets prizes but little money. Anyway, sit down. I'm glad of a break."
Hamish smiled at her. Angela had a rather vague face and wispy hair. Her cooking was awful, and she was a rotten housekeeper. And yet Hamish thought the doctor was lucky to have such a great wife. Angela would no more consider managing anyone's life than she would consider jumping off a cliff. She was kind and caring, and the best listener in Loch Doo. Angela surprised him by pouring a slug of malt whiskey into his coffee.
"I hear Mrs. Wellington's about to get you married," said Angela.
"Is that the reason for the whiskey?"
"Thought you would need a bracer. I met the Curry sisters, and they told me that Mrs. Wellington has a niece who needs a husband, and you need the love of a good woman to reform you. Got any holiday owing?"
"Maybe she's pretty," said Hamish, "but maybe she's got a tweedy soul. I want to talk to you about these murders."
"Supposed to be solved. So begin at the beginning and go on to the end."
Hamish talked and talked. The whiskey sank lower in the bottle as Angela kept refilling their mugs, without bothering about any more coffee. When he had finished, Angela said,
"I think Daviot's gone mad. There is no concrete evidence to tie these young lads to the murder."
"Aye, but it's been through the sheriff's court and heading for the High Court in Edinburgh. They seem to think the circumstantial evidence is enough."
"Let me think," said Angela. "I know, I've got an idea. Have you heard of Ruby Souter?"
"No."
"She was at school with me. I've got her phone number somewhere. She's a ball-breaking advocate and publicity mad, and a feminist. Now, if I ask her to take on this case for the defence, she might, if she thinks she'd get a lot of headlines. That's the first thing. Then, I've heard a lot about Professor Gordon. This is still John Knox country, and his anti-God, anti-Jesus rants roused hatred in a lot of bosoms."
"And Olivia was a manipulator," exclaimed Hamish. "What if she knew something about the professor's murder?"
"There's another thing you seem to be avoiding," said Angela.
Her eyes began to close.
"No, don't go to sleep,"
said Hamish, realizing the whiskey had suddenly made Angela drunk.
"Friend at the castle. Where did the money come from?"
And with that, Angela gently laid her head on the kitchen table and went to sleep.
"I've never seen Angela drunk before," thought Hamish wildly.
He went into the living room and fetched a cushion and slid it under her head. As he walked to the police station and the fresh air hit him, he began to feel drunk himself. He began to do cartwheels along the waterfront. Nessie Curry let the net curtain fall back into place and phoned Mrs. Wellington to tell her that Macbeth had taken to the bottle. 2 days later, Hamish was preparing a leisurely breakfast when there came a loud knocking at the front door. He went through to the living room and shouted,
"Side door, that one's stuck."
When he opened the kitchen door, he saw a tall woman with a face like an angry horse staring accusingly at him. "The blue lamp is over the front door," she snapped, "so as a servant of the public, you should have unstuck it." This, thought Hamish, must be Mrs. Wellington's reforming niece. "I am not interested in marriage," he said. "Are you mad? I am Ruby Souter." "Oh, I am sorry. The minister's wife has been threatening to send along a good woman to reform me. You're the advocate." "That's me. Let's talk." Well, thought Hamish, after Ruby had left, "I wanted to talk it over with someone, and never have I had such a grilling in my life. I'm surprised Angela even remembered to call her." Hamish phoned Charlie and said he was going to go over to Drim and that he would ring him if there was anything urgent. But before he went, Hamish called a second cousin who worked as a stockbroker in Glasgow and asked him to find out if a man called Hanover Ebrington had sold off Lady Jane sanitary towels. He waited for a reply and was relieved to find out that Handy had told him the truth. The weather was still fine, and Drim looked less menacing than usual, although most of the waters on the long finger of Loch were black because the towering mountains kept out the sun. He threw sticks for the dogs at the edge of the loch, and then strolled up to the castle to be greeted by Handy. "I thought you'd forgotten me," said Handy. "Come in." Hamish looked up at the scaffolding. "Who was working on the buildings, and when were they last here?" "A firm from Invergordon. They stopped for the winter. It's just a job of repointing, mostly." "What's the name of the firm?" "Comstock Builders." "What is this?" "I know. You're worried about the murders." "So am I." Hamish followed Handy into his study. "Frieda's left me to go back to Glasgow. I'm thinking of getting a housekeeper. Any suggestions?" "You have a cleaner, haven't you?" "I get a squad over once a week from an agency in Brakey." "Why not get some women from Drim? Help the local economy." "When a man is single, women around the place are a pest. They all start thinking of marriage." "Coffee?" "Yes, thanks. About the murders, Ruby Souter is going to defend the smugglers." "Then you'd better hope they had nothing to do with the murders, because Ruby will get them off. There is nothing in the world more terrifying than the sight of a female Scottish ball-breaking advocate in full flight. I know what's worrying you. No weapon, no real proof. I've asked around, no connection to the professor, although the idea is that he chanced upon them. Here's your coffee. Help yourself to milk and sugar." "There is one thing I've been thinking over," said Hamish. "We've still got a lot of Calvinists around, and they wouldn't like the idea of the prof telling them that there isn't a God. To them that means no guilt and go forth and sin. Gets their knickers in a right twist." "I saw the film of him preaching, but I was only looking for a familiar face, and that was when I saw Olivia in the audience. She's very manipulative. Maybe she lured him to the tower in Drim, but she would need to know the wails and hauntings were fake." Both fell silent. At last Hamish said, "I'd like to look at the Strathbane film again. I saw the bits they showed on television. I wonder about the bits they didn't show. I mean, maybe someone threatened him. I think I'll go and have another talk to the producer." "Give me a moment and I'll come with you," said Handy. He saw Hamish hesitate. "Bless the man," cried Handy. "Hamish, you think I might be your murderer?" "Something like that," mumbled Hamish, embarrassed. "So how better than a close study? Off you go. I'll join you outside." "What if he is a murderer?" thought Hamish uneasily. "He could bump me off up on the moors, and no one would ever suspect him." But when Handy climbed into the passenger seat, he seemed his usual affable self. "The trouble is," said Handy, "that policemen, however retired they may be, always have something of the villain about them." "Drive on. I'm not going to kill you." He gave a stage laugh. "Not today, anyway."
They were told at Strathbane Television that producer Dermot Lancey was in the canteen. Dermot did not look at all pleased to see them, as he was just about to demolish a large steak pie and chips smothered in brown sauce.
"You'll just need to wait," he said crossly. "I'm famished."
Hamish leaned back and looked at the ceiling to avoid the sight of Dermot with bits of pie and other detritus sticking to his black beard. He washed the lot down with a large mug of tea, burped loudly, and finally rose to his feet.
"Come on, then," he said. "I'm a busy man, got a special to finish. Save a hedgehog for posterity. Gripping stuff. Goes out at prime time. Introduced by the on-model Fiona Morris. Opening shot. She's wearing nothing but hedgehogs. That'll get the punters."
"Beavers might have been a more appropriate subject," murmured Handy.
"Here, Mac, you taking the piss?"
"Not me," said Handy quickly. "Just worried folk might think it cruelty to hedgehogs."
"The toy hedgehogs, get it?"
"Got it."
"You want to see the outtakes, do you?" asked Dermot.
"Please," said Hamish.
"I'll turn you over to Liz here. I've got more important things to do."
Liz was a flat-chested girl with bright orange hair and thin, stick-like arms covered in tattoos.
"Here yez are,"
she said, in a thick Glaswegian accent.
"Stop there," said Hamish suddenly.
He and Handy looked. A man was on his feet, waving a Bible and shouting something.
"Och, him," said Liz. "The researcher on this was Kyle Kennedy. I'll get him."
They waited until she returned.